You're listening to Renegade Broadcasting.
Hello. You're listening to...
Yeah, hi, Richard.
Yes. One moment. I hear you fine. Hello, everyone. You're listening to Renegade Broadcasting. That's renegadebroadcasting.com. And today is Monday, October 30th, 2017. I'm your host, Richard Kadokevich. And you're listening to Arcane Semantics. I'm very pleased to say I have a very interesting guest returning today. Returning for me as I've interviewed with him on a previous network, but also returning to Renegade Broadcasting. He's actually interviewed here just under 3 years ago now. It was December 2014 when he was here last. But we have with us today a very, very brilliant man, returning Michael Santomoro. Michael is a journalist who's been noted by the New York Times as a world-famous blogger and publisher. He's lived and operated a business in Manhattan previous to 9/11 and had analyzed and written about the forces behind the disaster. Michael is a noted Holocaust revisionist researcher and is publisher of the book Debating the Holocaust, A New Look at Both Sides by Thomas Dalton. Hello, Michael. Thank you for being with us here tonight.
Hi, Richard. It's good to be with you.
Yes, certainly. I really enjoyed our interview on the other network in the past, and originally I couldn't find any history you had at this station, but when I checked again just earlier today, I caught the interview you did with Renegade Broadcasting. I managed to catch the majority of it. I did like that a lot as well, and it seems that a lot of those issues are if anything, just more relevant in the time that has passed in the last 3 years, wouldn't you say?
I would agree with that. I don't recall the interview you're making reference to. Who was interviewing me? Do you remember?
The host's name was Dana.
Okay.
And I believe you mentioned Ferguson. I think it was shortly after that, and then you got on the topic a lot of free speech, and you know, talked a lot about just the bureaucracy that exists as well. Went off to quite a few topics.
Free speech is at its being threatened in this country more than ever, at least in my lifetime. I don't know if you know recently in Texas. Because of Hurricane Harvey, there are people who are in need of FEMA help. And there's a Texas state law that passed this past May, and signed by the governor of Texas that does not allow hurricane relief funds to be given to residents who boycott Israel, who are part of the BDS, the boycott divestment sanctions. So Houston suburb, many suburbs that have been affected by the hurricane are saying to relief applicants, don't boycott Israel if you want FEMA money or state local money as well. I find that amazing. I don't know if you're familiar with the stipulations, but you have to suspend any kind of peaceful boycotting of Israel during the time you get the monies. But after you've been finished, after the monies have been allocated, and you know, that can take 2 or 3 years, then you can resume back to boycotting Israel. So you have to suspend any BDS activities to get your aid if you've been a victim of Hurricane Harvey. I find that amazing. I find that shocking. I've spoken to Jewish Americans who identify with their Jewish roots, and they're embarrassed by such a stipulation. They weren't aware of it until I pointed it out to them to a current events class that I belong to here on Hilton Head Island in South Carolina. And I have to tell you, this kind of power that Jews push is not benign. It's malignant. Obviously, if it was benign, they wouldn't be pushing it. But if the Jewish power in this country was benign, nobody would even care or talk about it, because we'd be going about our businesses, but our personal lives wouldn't be affected. But if you suspend any kind of peaceful boycott of anything that you want to boycott, then you leave people no other choice but to resort to terrorist activities. This is why it's very important for every group, whether it be Black Lives Matter or the alt-right or whatever, they should always have access to a platform or a venue where they can voice their point of view. And I actually prefer that they all have access to the news wires or the TV and radio wires, where they can express themselves for an hour or two to convey their point of view, and to give them a regular platform so that people don't have to demonstrate on a street level and violence can erupt from that, or obviously it's important to always give groups a peaceful venue to harp on their gripes or whatever their agenda is. Otherwise, you're going to resort to people are going to resort to violent acts to get their point across. I mean, we see it on the world stage, what's going on. When you don't give people their right to express themselves, if you pass laws where you prohibit people from expressing themselves, it's going to cause resentment, anger, and frustration. I mean, the reason why they're boycotting anything is because they're already angry and resentful and frustrated.
And, yes, and as far as just how many things this brings to mind, just your freedoms, both in what you choose to purchase or not, and freedom of speech is greatly violated here. It's interesting that it's also regarding humane assistance, humanitarian effort, and yet, you know, you have to be in complete agreement in spite of how the Israeli government treats the Palestinians, which is rather ironic there. And thirdly, it just that, I don't know, a while back, you know, in the previous generation, the amount of influence the Jews and Israel had over the politicians was a bit more concealed, was it not? I mean, it's just amazing how bold and out in the open it is, just as far as just a few observations I can't help but make there.
Yeah. Well, you know what? It's an interesting comment that you just made. It seems like it's more bold, but that's because we have access to the internet the last 17, 20 years, you know, where everybody's already hooked on, you know. It's only been around the year 2000 that everybody eventually had a home computer. So I think it's more bold and pronounced because we have access to alternative media such as the one that you're part of. And I think the alternative media is the only media that I'm aware of that is exposing the very thing that I just mentioned. Because what I just mentioned, other than the Dallas News mentioning it on a local level, you don't see it on CNN. You don't see it on Fox News. You don't see it on the mainstream media because, you know, five out of the six major media conglomerates in this country are dominated by Jewish Americans in ownership and stockholders and shareholders. And so they play up to their, you know, they protect their Jewish sensibilities. That's why you're not going to hear about it on the news. If it wasn't for the internet, we wouldn't even be talking right now about this. There's another bill that's being trying to be passed on the in the Congress. They have 42, or maybe now it's 43 senators signed up on it, including Chuck Schumer from New York State, the so-called free speech advocate, but only if it serves as purpose, free speech. There's a law that they're trying to pass that if you boycott Israel, if you're part of the BDS, Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions movement, you can go to jail for 20 years. I mean, that's what the law would be if it was to pass. I mean, to think that they almost have half the Senate signing on to this bill, most of them happen to be Republicans. I think two-thirds of them are Republicans. It's a pretty scary, scary situation. Again, this power that Jews have in America is not benign. It's malignant. And getting back to that Senate bill that Chuck Schumer signed on to, along with 42 other senators, it's a minimum penalty of $250,000 fine, up to $1 million, and up to 20 years imprisonment. I would love to be the poster boy if such a law was to pass. I don't even know if Trump would have the guts to veto such a bill. And hopefully the U.S. Supreme Court would rule it unconstitutional. But again, the idea that it even exists, that people spend time thinking it out, writing such a bill, and to try to pass such a law, I think we're living in scary times. By the way, what Jews have been doing in American politics has been going on for almost 100 years. So when you say it's more bold and out there, no, it's because of the internet and the alternative media that it seems that it's more bold and out there. But Jews have been doing it behind the scenes, going back to the 1930s with Un-American Activities or something like that. The Committee for Un-American Activities, originally in the 1930s, it was founded on the idea of going after right wingers like Nazi sympathizers and all that. And they use the same laws that they passed in the 1930s to go after the communists who were disproportionately Jewish. So they overplayed their card there. It was founded by Jewish politicians who wanted to go after right wingers. And then they would front it with Gentiles to run the committee. I mean, this has always been part of the group's strategy in the Jewish community. I mean, they really are chess players. They're not playing checkers. They're always thinking things out way ahead of time. As a matter of fact, one of the rabbis at the Simon Wiesenthal Center, Rabbi Cooper, in 1997, in the corporate minutes, he said, the internet should not be a debating society. It should be just for commerce. And think about it. In 1997, this guy was concerned about the internet being a debating society when it really was just in the beginning. I guess in the beginning, it was more of a debating society. It wasn't really what we do it. I mean, there wasn't much commerce going on the internet like we have today. So it was predominantly more like a debating society. As a matter of fact, Holocaust revisionism was one of the first debating points on the internet back in the early 90s, mid-90s until the late 90s. It was actually a bigger thing then than it is today on the internet. So the idea that he would say, oh, it shouldn't be a debating society, he felt fear and he sensed that it was going to be a big thing where it was going to address Jewish power that's malignant. I mean, there's always going to be power in any group, whether it be Asians or any group, it's going to have some power, hopefully, you know, blacks, Hispanics, but it's the Jewish power that's really interfering more so in our lives than any other kind of power out there.
If we could back up for a minute, I noticed on that other interview, you didn't get a chance to delve too much into your past, you know, growing up or related to 9/11 or the publishing of this book. It was mostly touching on other issues. So perhaps the listeners would appreciate a bit of these eras described by you, starting with your childhood. I mean, you mentioned you grew up in the around, you've known a lot of Jewish people and gotten into their minds, you know, your whole life, basically. If you could mention maybe your time in the Bronx.
I grew up in Pelham Park in the Bronx, which is probably, if not one of the last, if not the last, rather, blue-collar Jewish neighborhoods in the Bronx, where half of my Jewish friends were high school dropouts. I mean, we were all in the same boat in terms of our economic status. We weren't, we were just struggling. And it was the 60s or 70s. For me, it was mostly the 70s. I had two older brothers, one 12 years old than me, the other 7 years old. I mean, they had the same experiences, but I was predominantly surrounded by Jewish friends because that's the neighborhood I grew up in. I was a Shabbos boy for the synagogue across the street. Then I started my own company. I graduated high school early, and then I dropped out of college. I started my own company in New York City called Roommate Finders. And the bulk of my clientele were Jewish. So when I was a kid, as a teenager, whatever ethnocentric things my Jewish friends would express and what I experienced, I took it with a grain of salt because when you're kids, you're not really mature enough to think things out. But then when I had this clientele that were in their mid to late 20s into their 30s and even their 40s, the same mentality existed. And it started making me question the culture of Jews. I have to tell you, they have their own way of expressing themselves amongst themselves. And I have to say that my phenotypes are mistaken for Jewish. So a lot of times when I was running Roommate Finders, people thought I was Jewish. And they would say some of the most obnoxious, arrogant, hateful things about non-Jews. And I'm not talking about blacks and Hispanics. I'm talking about everybody, white Gentiles. And it did get worse with black and Hispanic. I have to say that as a group, Jews are one in this culture, I would have to say from my experience, have to be the most racist, hateful group of people. Even though about a third to half of the young marry outside their faith, there's still this insistence that the kids be raised Jewish. There's still this insistence that the spouse convert. And you would think that if they're marrying somebody outside of their faith, they would be more open-minded. But they're no different than the ones that only want to marry amongst themselves. It's just, I don't get it. So it's almost like schizophrenic. It doesn't make any sense. On the one hand, they're willing to, you know, for a good third to half of them, depending what age bracket we're talking about, and which data we're basing it on. But let's say a third of the Jewish community is marrying outside their faith. And yet they have the same ethnocentric, arrogant, obnoxious views about non-Jews. I don't get it. I don't get it that they're willing to procreate outside their ethnicity. And some Jews, many Jews actually, I would say most Jews think of themselves as a race. And I can see both sides, but I don't think it is a race because there are Hispanic Jews, there are black Jews, or I met Vietnamese Jews. I mean Jews in all different, you know.
Right. Well, I think on that point, you know, perhaps there would be too much inbreeding in the long run if that weren't the case. So they'll breed in using their preferences. I believe they want someone to have a Jewish mother for them to accept them, right, as a Jew.
Right.
But Yeah, perhaps to prevent, too much inbreeding. They've acquired various Gentile genes as a and you said what, approximately one third are the statistics?
Well,
there?
That's the lowest number I've heard. I've heard as high as 50%, but I'm just going to be conservative because a lot of this data is speculative. I mean, they try to make it as scientific as possible. So let's say about a third of Jews are marrying outside their faith. I think it may be even higher, maybe 40 to 50%, but whatever it is, it's a high percentage. And by the way, in Israel, by law, you can't marry outside your faith, your religion. But they'll recognize the marriage when you do it outside the state of Israel. So if you take a boat ride to Cyprus, you come back, they'll recognize the marriage. So it's, but the idea that they make it difficult for you to get married inside Israel, I find it amazing. It's such a racialist outlook, and we support the state of Israel billions of dollars a year in foreign and military aid.
Well, yeah, the way they treat the Palestinians, as one example, I think shows the supremacy. Even when we have a lot of white nationalists, a lot of us around Renegade here, might not prefer that exact term, a lot of us, but, have such sentiments to preserve your race and people, to be against the genocide of the white race, but not a supremacy that, insists on, doing harm or genociding others in the proceeds. And I mean, I think there is a Jewish supremacy that surpasses any sort of pride of other races in maintaining their cohesion.
I agree. You mentioned the Palestinians back in I'm forgetting the year. Was it the year? I don't know if it was 2015 or 2014, whatever year it was that the Israelis invaded the Gaza Strip. I remember the month of July. I think it was July of 2014. And, after about almost 2,000 Palestinian civilians getting killed, Hamas got lucky and they captured an Israeli soldier, and CNN and Fox News were reporting it as a kidnapping. Now, as far as I'm aware of, and I have done a deep search on it, it's the first time in the history of war reporting that a POW get referred to as a kidnapped individual. This is the kind of vernacular that Jews have control of, that Don Lemons and Anderson Cooper would actually say it with a straight face in front of the camera, that Hamas kidnapped an Israeli soldier. It's almost an impossibility. I mean, in the middle of a warfare, both sides are trying to capture each other. There's no such thing as kidnapping. It's in the middle of a warfare. It's a POW situation. And one print media outlet in the Midwest referred to it as an abduction, as if they were captured on, as if they were an alien or something, an abduction. I mean, it's just crazy. It's just crazy that this kind of vernacular is used with such success that people don't even realize how they've been taken. Their minds are being exploited. Their minds are being controlled and dominated by a sliver of the population that's very cohesive, very powerful, powerful in terms of the billionaire and millionaire class, media ownership. And this power that I'm referring to is obviously Jewish, and it's not a benign power. That's what the problem is. It's a malignant power, and people have the courage to point it out.
And you became aware of a lot of this, even from people around you growing up, as you describe.
Yeah, but growing up, it's one thing when you're kids.
Right. But then I know how much the 9/11 experience you've written about yourself, how much that also solidified, just seeing how much influence
I had an ex-Israeli girlfriend of mine call me the day after 9/11, and she told me there was joy in the voices and the expressions of a lot of Israelis that had happened to us 9/11.
I find it interesting that you said earlier that day, the day of 9/11, earlier that day before it happened, you noticed a lot of peculiarities, as it were, of a lot of people around you who seemed, yeah, just a bit off.
Not earlier. No.
Really? Because
I was sleeping. No.
And all right. I think maybe I misheard some of your description of that day.
It happened the day after and 2 days after.
Oh, okay.
But it wasn't anything that I did not have any knowledge or any feeling beforehand. But there was reports that used to be on the FBI website where two Israelis who worked nearby the World Trade Center were told a few hours before it happened, like 3 hours before the event, not to show up for work. So obviously somebody in Israel, in this particular company, were aware of, otherwise they wouldn't be telling their employees, or at least these two employees. And there may be other emails that we don't know about where it happened the same way.
We've heard of a lot of connections related to Israel, certainly, and Israeli companies surrounding the event and the building. But I guess my main point really was just that your awareness of Jewish power and this Jewish supremacy, as inhumane as it is, you were aware of this in stages, some from your childhood, some from the 9/11 event. You really took a little bit more at face value, I believe you said at first, and then in later years, as you wrote on it more.
When I was experiencing it in my work in the 80s and 90s, again, I was in denial about it. And it wasn't until the mid-90s that I waked up to it. And then the late 90s when I got exposed to the internet.
Looks like we have a break coming in. We'll be back in like three minutes.
Sure, no problem.
Money, government, media, and academia. Repeat.
Jews are poor. The government and media are anti-Semitic.
Hola! You've just heard Chosen, one of the oldest languages known to ape. Try another. Mayenta is fat, ugly, and Sephardi.
My wife is beautiful, intelligent, and spiritual.
Good job! We have Chosen learning pods in synagogues, lodges, even selected pizza restaurants. Learn Chosen and stay ahead.
Vaccines are safe. The Holocaust was real.
So fluent, so chosen. Fees, obligations, and genital mutilation apply.
We'll be right back.
And we're back, everyone. Sorry, Michael, you were describing how in the 90s you were still a bit in denial.
Yeah, I mean, most of the, from 1979 to about 94, 95, I was in denial about the you know, I had no problem with the idea of a Zionist state. I thought it was like a worldwide version of the quota system, that Jews need to have a protective territory because of all the atrocities that happened to them. And, you know, this whole idea of Holocaust revisionism was I mean, I can't say I wasn't hearing it in the background on talk radio, but it wasn't until I was exposed to the internet around 97 or 98 that I really wake up to this. And the internet has been a university education for me, plus my exposure to Kevin McDonald's trilogy on the subject matter from an evolutionary psychological perspective. It's like a PhD being exposed to the internet. It's like earning a PhD on this subject matter. And what fascinates me, see, at the time, I didn't even know until I was exposed to the internet that there was such a thing as Holocaust denial laws. As a matter of fact, I still meet people from these very countries that have these laws. They don't even know about it. The whole idea that you couldn't question an historical period blew me away. I was like, what? And that is the only taboo in 20th century history, or any century in this day and age, where you cannot question it in about 19 or 20 countries now, where you can go to jail. And I've met people who spent 3, 5 years, a year in jail, 8 months in jail, you know, from David Irvin to Guillermo Rudolph and Dr. Frederick Tobin and the late Ernst Zundel. I mean, the idea that people actually ended up going to jail because they questioned historical period, and the fact that they're trying to do the same thing with people who are peacefully protesting with the BDS movement, where they can go to jail for 20 years. Most of the time, the sentence for Holocaust denial is 5 years. And here in the United States, they're not, currently as we speak, they're not trying to pass Holocaust denial laws, but I have met law professors, I've spoken to them, who happen to be Jewish, who would love to see Holocaust denial laws in the United States. Now, Israel was the first country to pass such a law in 1986, and they were able to successfully pressure France and Germany to do so in 1989 and 1990. And then by the mid-90s, a dozen other countries have passed such laws. That's how powerful the Israel lobby is in all these European capitals, both Western and Eastern Europe. I mean, the State Department has what's called the anti-Semitic desk. I mean, think about it. They're the only group, religious or ethnic-wise, that has such a division within the State Department. So the anti-Semitic desk determines who to be penalized, what country to penalize or to interfere with, if anything has anything that they perceive as anti-Semitic. Let me just say something about the slogan anti-Semitic. 95% of the time when you read the reports in newspapers and listen to it on radio and TV, they never ever mention what it is that the other person said that was anti-Semitic. That's because when you do a deep search, I mean, when you find out on your own what it is that they said, it was not anti-Semitic. The other 5% of the time when they do report the quote, it is anti-Semitic. But if you notice how they report this stuff, 95% of the time they will not verbatim, they will not do a quote quote anything, because it's not anti-Semitic. They would not be saying anything that would be truly anti-Semitic. Did I lose you? Are you there?
Oh, yeah. Yes, I'm still here. Yeah, no, I'm just thinking of, just the different stages. Well, you mentioned with the different countries adding on. I know it was reduced to the amount of countries with these laws at one point, and then it increased again to, you said, 19 at current.
Yeah, it was at 15, and then it was down to 12 or 11, and then it went up to 19. I'm losing track, but whatever amount it is, 10, 15, or 20, I can't even believe there's any population agreeing to such a law. But that's the kind of power that the Israel lobby has. You know, Mersheimer and Waltz wrote a book called The Israel Lobby, and they cite 95% of what they cite in their footnotes are coming from Jewish sources, where Jews actually boast about the power they have over the European capitals and the United States, and what influence they even have in Asia, and by extension. Well, you talk to Asian diplomats, you get to meet them, and you talk to business people from the Eastern Hemisphere, and they always tiptoe around the Jewish issue. I mean, they know that they're a very powerful group, and they seem to be more hip about it than we Americans. You would think Americans living in the society that we're in would know about it, but they're not aware of it because, again, unless there's a critical mass point where enough people are being exposed to the alternative media that's on the internet, they're not going to be hip to it. They're going to be very docile about the issue of Jewish power and how malignant it is. And as long as people are glued to Fox News or CNN, or MSNBC, they're just not going to get it. They're not going to get what you and I get and what many of your listeners get.
Yes, you've become very active on these topics over the years. I forget the person, but you had questioned a Holocaust reparations survivor on live television in the past. Isn't that right?
Well, with a crew of cameras around me, one in particular, I guess the big name in the group was CNN, and I remember talking or contacting a reporter at the time for CNN at that scene, and he said that it got cut out in the cutting room. I find that hard to believe. But the woman in the wheelchair, I asked her if she was in Auschwitz I or Auschwitz II, because it was one of those camps that the Jews were congregated in. I couldn't remember myself, and she remembered, and we got a laugh out of that. And then I asked her about, did you see any gas chambers? And she said, no, I didn't hear about any of it until after the war. She said, I didn't hear anything about gas chambers until after the war. So there she was for a number of years, from 41 to 45. She's in the camp system for 4 years. She doesn't know anything about gas chambers until after the war.
And you've known a number of people who've done considerable research on the topic of the Holocaust revisionism. Norman Finkelstein, isn't that right? In addition to the person whose book you published, Thomas Dalton?
Yeah, I published a book called Debating the Holocaust, A New Look by Thomas Dalton. By the way, I was influenced by Jewish Holocaust revisionists. There are Holocaust revisionists out there who are Jews, and some of them are prominent. David Kramer is one of them. He's not prominent, but he was a blogger, and I was influenced by him, who happens to be Jewish. He lives in Queens, New York. David Cole, who's sort of a semi-revisionist, he sort of backpedaled on a few points about it, but he influenced me. There's a Ginsburg. He passed away back in the 90s. He was a Romanian Jew. He was a hyphenated Jew, but he also was in the camp system. And then there was leftist, the father of Holocaust revisionism, Paul Rosenair. He was a leftist socialist who actually was partially paralyzed the rest of his life after his incarceration in the camps. And you would think he'd be mad enough. You know, he was so mad at what happened to him, but he still had the honesty and integrity to say, wait a minute, what are you guys talking about? There were no homicidal gas chambers in these camps. And he was proven right. You know, at one time it was suggested that 20 of the concentration camps all had gas chambers, and then it dwindled down to 6. Now we're down to about 5 that they claim. Well, qualitatively, the evidence that they have for all those camps is the same kind of quality evidence they have for the remaining 5 camps that they claim that they have gas chambers. So.
Well, yes, just even the design, it was pointed out, wouldn't have worked. These holes in the ceiling that supposedly you would drop, you know, canisters of the gas in through it. It wouldn't even make sense. They said there, you know, you would have residue you would still find as well, which there had never been any traces of in a lot of these primary sites that were supposedly gas chambers. And the 6 million number throughout history, of course, has been a favorite to the Jews, so it was no new number, and that of course didn't help their story either. But yeah, no, I mean, the evidence of the chemical, you've heard that they haven't really found evidence of the chemical, I'm sure, right?
Well, the chemical that was used for delousing purposes, and there were delousing gas chambers, which doesn't make any sense if they were looking to kill these people, or it wasn't just Jews, by the way, they were being claimed to be killed, but sticking to, you know, actually in the beginning, there were non-Jews claiming the same thing. I mean, there were priests who survived the camp in Dachau making claims that they were being slaughtered. They were also making claims of gas chambers being used there. So it wasn't just Jews doing that. But what got me so interested in the subject matter is the fact that there were Holocaust denial laws. That this would happen decades after the war. I mean, it still would shock me if it was after, you know, even if it was a year after the war. The fact that there were any kind of law that prohibited you from questioning an historical period, I think that speaks volumes. I think that speaks volumes in itself. You know?
Certainly, I agree. And with Thomas Dalton, you just decided to collaborate. I don't know, by that point, you were already convinced information should get out there to more people. And his approach tried to be quite neutral, as it were.
Well, you know, I have to say, I'm always open to being wrong. But when you have laws prohibiting you from questioning a historical period, when you have laws that are imprisoning scholars, and when you have people who are advocating more laws like that, the story doesn't hold up. The narrative has to be extremely weak for it to hold up if you have to have laws protecting it. And Israel and Jews around the world use it as a weapon on a daily basis. I mean, you can do a Google search and there's always some news item about the Holocaust. I didn't see it, but somebody told me yesterday that there was a segment on 60 Minutes yesterday on Sunday on something about the Holocaust. I don't know what it was about, you know, whatever it was always about the idea that there's always something about the Holocaust. And sometimes during Christmas seasons, there could be 3, 4, 5 Holocaust movies released in the month of December. It's been replaced. It's been in some years, it replaces Christmas movies. Yeah, you know, Christmas week is one of the most biggest selling of movie tickets. You know, people get together for family. They have days off from work and school, and they go to the movies. I don't know if you remember, but there have been some years in the last 20 years where the only movie you can go see during Christmas week is a Holocaust flick. And coincided many times, not always, but many times it coincided with some kind of excursion or invasion that the Israelis would do in the West Bank or the Gaza Strip. And I can't think that, this is too much of a coincidence. I think it's a very orchestrated thing that the Israelis and Hollywood work together. And there are script doctors in Hollywood that, eliminate anything that could be derogatory about Jews or Israel. That's why when Marlon Brando was on the Larry King show back in the 90s, and he said you never see a kike on the movie screen. For the most part, he's right. It's rare, but you'll see all the derogatory stereotypes of every ethnic group out there but the Jews.
Yes, yeah, we'll see a lot of positive depictions of the U.S.-Israeli relationship out of Hollywood as well. A lot of these series, for example, like NCIS, for example, had that positive U.S.-Israeli cooperative image. And of course, the people of Hollywood had been threatened to not speak out about Gaza. That was very popular around, 2014, I think, when there was a lot of bombing going on. And it's certainly, well, I mean, the all of the major companies, I was sharing a couple of those articles with you talking about all the tech tyrants, YouTube and Google and Facebook, just a lot of them consolidating. And even under the current administration, yeah, there's a lot more draconian laws you're mentioning they're trying to pass now.
Credit card processing shutdowns on sites where they question Jewish power. A lot of these credit card processing companies are boycotting or eliminating them as an account. There's other websites that have been shut down, at least temporarily, because the host doesn't want to web server doesn't want to host them anymore. The kind of stuff that these Jewish organizations spend time doing. They're just looking to destroy any contrarian view out there. I mean, that's what their whole budget is based on. They're almost a $10 billion annual budget. There's about 300 organizations in the Jewish community. They overlap each other on the mission statement. But they have a budget of $10 billion, which exceeds about half of the world's country's national budget. And they devote all their time and energy for propaganda purposes. They sanitize textbooks, or they try to sanitize textbooks with high success. They do that with courses that are offered on a college level or high school level. It's just amazing. I was talking to somebody who was going for his master's or maybe PhD in literature, and he was at NYU, and he was telling me how everything was centered from a Jewish perspective. I mean, it could have been a piece of literature that had nothing to do with Jews, but somehow the professor would sort of invoke something Jewish about something that had nothing to do with Jews in the literature. It's an amazing phenomenon. Jews fascinate the hell out of me. I mean, they just fascinate me because they just always try to see things from a Jewish angle or perspective, even when it's not there. Mm-hmm. It boggles my mind. And what amazes me is that the Gentile mindset accepts it. They just absorb it and accept it as part of the course, part of daily existence, not knowing they're being exploited and taken advantage of.
Oh, yeah, the Christian population is so conditioned to support Israel in the U.S. We've talked a lot about this recently on the network. And, a lot of these companies recently, even like GoDaddy, PayPal, we've heard have been limiting a lot more based on these sort of concerns. Also, since Charlottesville, we've heard a lot of crackdowns. I know you found that pretty outrageous as well, Michael.
Oh, again, you need to have venues for people to voice their gripes and their anger about something. I mentioned, people being docile about the Jewish question of Jewish power that's malignant in this culture. There's one group that I have to say is very hip to it, and that's blacks, African Americans. They just get it. They seem to get it. They're very astute to it, and boggles my mind that they get it. And white people generally don't. I mean, I don't know. Do you find any of your family or friends getting it about how malignant Jewish power is in this culture?
Well, I don't have too much of an extended family or have too much family who are living nearby, but I think that a lot of people are too preoccupied with the economy and just with a lot of the self-conscious focused propaganda and materialism, they get from the entertainment industry, marketing industry, in their lives, but also just trying to cope with the financial and unemployment factors a lot more these days to be able to. But it's all related. So it is something we need to wake more people up to. As far as you mentioning the black population, at least in the U.S., I could see in the past, them being a better allies toward goals of nationalism in the sense of each ethnicity, looking out for their own and being able to, just about everyone tends to self-segregate if left to their own accord. And that doesn't mean you want to do harm to others or kill others or anything like that, but we have a lot of forcing away from that here and in Europe. I wanted to get into more and be more in the second hour, but I think in the past, the original Black Panther Party could have been a better ally. The Black Panther Party, that the new one since then, of course, is moving away from that, and the Black Lives Matter. These are all moving further away from a good ally. But so I do hear what you're saying. In principle, but yeah, they get co-opted a lot. I mentioned how the even the Rastafari movement, which was very national and could be a nationalist, ally of sorts. They were manipulated by both Christianity and later by Muslim. It had warped, their ideals a bit, as well.
Well, what amazes me is that Jews as a group are very nationalistic when it comes to association with Israel, their support for Israel, but they don't want it for anybody else. I know it sounds like so cookie cut of a statement, but it's so true and it's so obvious. And when you talk to them on a one-to-one basis, they always have this Israeli exceptionalism. Oh, it's okay for the Jews based on what happened with the Holocaust. And that's why it's important to address the Holocaust. We have to dismantle the lies about the Holocaust for us to get beyond this Israeli exceptionalism. I mean, Jews are emotional beings just like anybody else, and they don't really think it out other than to say, well, what happened to us with the Holocaust, that's why Israel has to exist. That's why we have to have Zionism. We have to have our own nationalism. But it doesn't mean that other groups should have it.
Yes, it could be a key point. And a lot of... Well, looks like we... hopefully we'll get Michael back in a moment. It looks like he lost his connection for a moment there. But yes, we do need to go back on the... Well, be able to convince people to go back on the offensive more, I think. And this could help facilitate that dismantling this Holocaust narrative that we've been subjected to, conditioned to, guilt-ridden through over the years, where now the political correct sentiment is that, whiteness has to be dismantled. And now we're told if you don't dismantle whiteness or are a supporter of that, then right, then you're a problem. I'm sorry, Michael, it looks like we lost you for a moment.
Yes,
there.
I'm sorry. I actually pressed the wrong button when I was trying to hang up on the other call. But anyway,
But no, I was just mentioning, well, commenting on your point there. And you know, now there's such, you know, a sentiment that's against that for others, like for whites, we have to go more on the offensive rather than the defensive. And you know, to be able to have the same concern with preserving our people as any other race, it's ridiculous we should even have to fight for that, but we do. And yeah, I think calling out this Holocaust narrative we've been programmed and conditioned toward for so long can be very helpful.
What fascinates me is that if the average Israeli, and I have no reason to think that 95% of the Israelis don't believe in the Holocaust. I mean, I think they all believe in the Holocaust narrative. You would think that they'd be the last group to do what they're doing to the Palestinians. You would think by extension, they said, well, look what happened to us only 60, 70 years ago. We shouldn't be doing this to the Palestinians. You would think. I don't get it. I mean, mm-hmm. I just, you know, whites have a guilt about what happened to blacks in this country. And it seems like in the culture of Judaism, there's no reason to have guilt unless it's something that's internal. I mean, they don't have any guilt of what they did, what they have done to the Palestinians and what they continue to do to the Palestinians. I mean, they are the true victims of this Holocaust narrative in many ways.
Well, I do hear that, there's debate over what influences them more. I know the people in Israel aren't all treated very well by their own government. Some people have regretted, you know, moving there, relocating there with their family after they, you know, no longer have a choice, you know, to reverse this decision. But there's definitely been a large amount of, hypocrisy, you know, as you say, in general. I think it just goes back to whether you're humane or not, or whether the supremacy exists that is there. I mean, some credit Zionism, the protocols more, some credit the Talmud with where some of this comes from more. You know, you've better, maybe we could touch on this more in the second hour as we're about to have the break start.
I think we should address, I mean, the Talmud you're right about. Protocols is it may be the shoe fits, but it's not a good example. It's a fraudulent document.
All right, we'll take like three. Okay.
YouTube showed me again.
After getting censored relentlessly on YouTube, with video after video and channel after channel getting taken down, we have decided to try a different approach.
We now have RenegadeVids.com, which features all the documentaries, parodies, compilations, sketches, and video discussions that are simply too accurate for the kosher censors.
There are now many hours worth of hard-hitting videos waiting for you to watch and share, so get on over to RenegadeVids.com.
Renegade Broadcasting, hard-hitting talk radio.
And we're back with Michael Santamoro. Michael, before the break, I was mentioning how some people credit more the protocols and some people credit the Talmud more for the way the Jewish mind tends to think.
Well, I think it's better, well, definitely more accurate to cite the Talmud. Mm-hmm. The protocols is a fraudulent document. I mean, I know the shoe may fit, but if you're going to use anything to substantiate or support your thesis, you might as well use accurate data. And the Talmud is, you know, it's accurate. I don't think we should refer to the protocols. If anything, why not refer to more relevant and more updated information like Kevin McDonald's work?
Certainly, but what would you say?
Work on the Talmud, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh well, yes. I mean, if you'd like to start with, you know, your comments on what you were going to say regarding the Talmud.
Well, I mean, yeah, the Talmud is. You know, you can download this book for free by Israel Shahak, who I didn't know until after his death was on the short list for. The Nobel Prize in chemistry. He was a major cancer researcher. He died very young. I think he was like late 60s, 68 or so. He's a diabetic. But he did a lot of he did a lot of research on the Talmud, and he was shocked to learn such hateful passages. I remember talking to one of my clients about it. His name was Ben Levine. He was Jewish, and he was aware of it, and he said that you shouldn't discuss this in public. This is going back to the mid-90s. You shouldn't discuss this in public or to people because you can get killed for it. And he himself was an Orthodox Jew. And for him to say something like that seems so out of character for him. But he was serious. He said that people get killed for disclosing things like that about the Talmud. What was I going to say? Oh, I have been accused of being anti-Semitic for citing things that are, you know, are current events. For instance, I don't know how many years back, but it was recent where this George Washington University student was self-inflicting anti-Semitic words on a door and SWAT stickers and what have you. And they caught her. After two of her claims, you know, they didn't know that she self-inflicted it. There was a police report about it. It was a hate crime investigation. So the university decided to put a video, a camera on her door, only to find on the third, fourth, and fifth time, it was her doing it. It was the Jewish student doing it. And I cited this out. I cited this to a group list that I belong to, and one woman thought what I was sending out to the group, which was a current events group list that I belong to here on Hilton Head Island, where we meet in person once a week, she was accusing me of being anti-Semitic based on the fact that I was reporting this very incident And another time, something more recent, there was this father and son team, both Americans living in Israel, where they were responsible for over 200 anti-Semitic incidents over the last year and a half or so. They got caught by the FBI working in Israel. And the Anti-Defamation League counts them as anti-Semitic acts, but they were self-inflicted by Jewish Americans living in Israel.
But they're still counted.
And the same woman accuses me of being anti-Semitic. I mean, this is just bizarre. The slogan that people throw out, you know, racist, anti-Semitic.
Hate speech.
Yeah, hate speech. 95% of the time, it's not. And they don't even cite, they don't even tell you what the quote is or what the claim is or what their agenda is or what they're saying. They don't want you to know that what they're saying is constructive criticism. I mean, I'm not saying there's a small percentage of true hateful acts and statements and anti-Semitism and racism. There really is, but the 95% of the time, it's not the case. If anything, the hate is coming more from the other side. The Antifa, I mean, they are really, really a hateful group. And this is where I agree with Trump when he was trying to convey that both sides are guilty of violent words or hateful words. But I actually think the Antifa is even worse than the alt-right in terms of hate and anger. And there's a disproportionate membership of Jews in the Antifa.
Well, we've also seen on the right, you know, and on the alt-right, in particular, you know, a lot of factions who can, you know, be taking on, you know, more and more of a potentially Jewish inclusive alt-right, focusing on the immigration problem, conservative values, as opposed to social justice warrior extremes, and you know, just these sort of more benign stances. But not going too far. There seems to be a lot of, with the Charlottesville, a lot of provocateurs who were there, you know, who are not legitimate in any capacity as well. You know, people supposedly representing the KKK. That woman who died, it turned out to be from a heart attack later, for that matter. But, you know, it's still, of course, used.
Well, I mean, she was still hit by a car. I don't know.
I don't believe she was hit by the car that was moving away. I thought she was hit by a car that car hit. But you know, either way, she died of a heart attack. But they're still claiming that death.
Well,
and two police officers, they're claiming in some helicopter, you know, crashed or something. They claimed three victims in some cases.
When you get hit by a car, I mean, I don't know enough about biology, what causes you to die, but whatever's happening by getting hit by a car, that's the reason why you may have gotten the heart attack or whatever else you may have gotten. I mean, that's the reason why she died. I mean, whether it's, you know, she was alive for 10 minutes before she died of a heart attack, but still it happened because she got hit by a car.
Yeah, well, it does seem, though, that, I mean, that event was scheduled right from the beginning to try to, you know, just implement a problem reaction solution sort of agenda. And basically, you know, I mean, the aftermath, you know, what we saw of people, including Trump himself, but, you know, they're using it for justification now for attempts at these new laws.
By the way, before I forget, I've been a victim of the Antifa and the JDO. The JDO is an offshoot of the Jewish Defense League. It's called the Jewish Defense Organization, and they never convey them in a negative way. As a matter of fact, the Antifa never gets mentioned that often by the media, the mainstream media. In the case of the JDO, they never mention to the readership that they're still classified as a domestic terrorist group by the FBI. when they write articles about whatever they're doing, when they demonstrate against me or what they did in the past, they always make it seem like I'm the bad guy. And yet they're the ones who are un-American. They're the ones who are trying to suppress my freedoms to express myself. It's amazing how people can codify paragraphs and the language in an article to make me, the victim, look like the bad guy, as if I'm the one who's causing the problem. And that's another thing about news reporting. It's a constant bias, where if you make any constructive criticism about the state of Israel, they'll find a way to sabotage you, and it could be years down the road. It may not be immediate. As a matter of fact, it's happening to Norman Finkelstein as we speak. He's going to be facing a criminal court on November 3rd because he wrote a letter to two attorneys accusing them of being shysters, and they happen to both be Jewish Americans, and they must have done something that they had some connection with in the court system, where they ended up arresting Norman Finkelstein in the middle of the night, and now he's going to be maybe facing 2 years of jail. And this is in New York State. We're talking about New York City here. You know, it's bad enough that Norman Finkelstein's been banned from Israel for, well, this is going back almost 10, I think it expired, but he was banned from Israel for 10 years. Now I think it's not the case anymore. The 10 years is expired. There's also another scholar out of New Zealand who's also threatened with a ban from entering Israel because he wrote a Holocaust revisionist thesis for his master's degree, who happened to be Jewish himself, and he had a lot of family in Israel, and denounced his own work, his own thesis, as a deal he made with the Israeli authorities so that he can enter Israel and not be arrested. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that nobody ever talks about. Nobody ever even cares to talk about. I mean, it's not that they don't care to talk about it. They don't even know. They don't even know any of this stuff that I just told you. And who can blame people for not knowing? I mean, like you said earlier, people are trying to make ends meet. They're trying to make a living. They're going about their lives to raise a family or what have you. And they, you know, they watch for a half hour Fox News or an hour of CNN. I mean, that's all you have to watch because it repeats itself every hour anyway. So they only get a little bit of what's going on in their lives, and they don't understand, a little bit of what's happening around their lives. They don't really understand how much corruption there is, how much dishonesty there is, how much power there is that they can destroy individuals like Norman Finkelstein, or try to destroy. I mean, I don't know if they succeed, but the idea that they're trying to destroy Norman Finkelstein, like they try to destroy me, they try to destroy a lot of people. And it's not so much the end result, it's the process. Again, it gets back to what I said earlier. It's a $10 billion industry in these Jewish organizations' budgets. There's about 300 of them, the top 50 of the bulk of it. They have the wealth and the power and the devotion to spend all their 8 hours of work at these institutes or these associations or the Anti-Defamation League or what have you. They devote all their time and energy being connected to the media, whether it be Hollywood, entertainment, news media, political organizations, to make sure that they monitor whatever's being said that will not hurt Jewish interest and Israeli interest. As a matter of fact, in a current events class I belong to, there's a number of Jews that are there, and I heard one guy slip. He says, "I come to these meetings to monitor." I thought that was an interesting choice of words, that this guy would actually come to a current events class to monitor. Now, when I bring up a lot of the issues that I addressed with you here on the radio show, it upsets a lot of people at the table. But none of them can claim that I'm not being accurate. None of them can claim that I'm being dishonest. None of them can claim that I'm being anti-Semitic. Just because I pointed out the kind of malignant power that Jews are expressing themselves with all these organizations, and AIPAC and what have you, with the Israel lobby. It embarrasses the Jews in this group that I belong to. As a matter of fact, it embarrasses the Gentiles who are afraid to speak up, who don't have the courage to speak up like I do. That's another thing I want to address. There's not enough courage in the organizations, whether it be the alt-right or whatever. There's just not enough courage among the Gentiles of America, who represent over 95% of the population. They just don't have the courage to speak up to the power that's controlling their lives. You know, it's a moral responsibility for any population to address the elite and the power in their own culture. And whatever that power may be, whether it's Asian, Black, WASP, or Jewish currently, that is a moral responsibility of the population, of the masses, to address it and to know if they're being taken advantage of. And if they do find out they're being taken advantage of, they should address it and have the courage to address it.
When I mentioned the mind of the Jewish people earlier and mentioned the Talmud, well, you cited the research of Dr. Kevin McDonald as well. The group sort of strategies, you mentioned their devotion and focus can lie being influential in social avenues, and then of course being in a position to profit in economic circles, but definitely the influence in all the key positions possible related to the media and in politics, lobby groups, both at the local and national level. We do need, we've seen a lot of work from their lobby groups toward this, gradual population displacement, this white genocide in Europe and in America.
Getting back to what you're saying about the immigration policies that the Jews push in this country, they've started back in 1925. They succeeded with the Immigration Act of 1965. Mm-hmm. And there are Jewish pundits and academics that are out there, and they're blunt about it, that the reason why they passed the 1965, or they pushed the passage of the 1965 Immigration Act, is to Nazi-proof the United States. That's what it was all about. They wanted less of a white population anywhere on this planet. It's about conquer and divide. Because Jews, again, don't think of themselves as white. For the most part, they think of themselves as a separate race. And they act that way in a very cohesive way. There is a pundit named Steinlight. Back in the 90s, he gave a talk at a City College or Graduate Center in Manhattan, where he thought he helped support and pass the 1965 Immigration Act, but he thought it wasn't a good idea, that the new groups that are arriving to the United States, whether they be Hispanic or Asian, they can't relate to our Jewish agenda. He was speaking to a predominantly Jewish group. We're better off with white Europeans. Actually, he went as far to suggest that we're better off with white nationalists having an alliance with them to serve Jewish interest in the state of Israel. It's interesting how he felt that the Jews overplayed their card, and that Hispanics, one of the fastest growing groups in the United States, don't really care about the Holocaust, don't care about Israel, they don't have a connection with Israel. A lot of white groups do have a connection with Israel because of the Bible Belt, and there's a lot of Christian Zionists in this country, especially here on Hilton Head Island. Israel can't do any wrong. It's amazing. You know, when you think about the Old Testament, it's like the perfect blueprint for Jews, part of a group strategy. I mean, there's a book out now called The Jesus Hoax, where his thesis is he thinks Paul created Christianity to undermine the Roman Empire. I mean, I have questions about that thesis, but it's interesting. I mean, if you think about it overall, the whole idea of the Old Testament and creation of the Christianity and New Testament, it really serves Jewish interests all the time.
And, well, what you were mentioning about the sort of immigration policies, even the, I know you've commented in the past that, you know, even the affirmative action in this country really should have been limited by this point, you know, it's past due for that. But the Jews prefer being one of among many minorities in any country to not gain as much attention is always pointed out. Are the energies and alliances, though, we could benefit from with a lot of other races rather than being subjected to divide and conquer? You know, you mentioned Black nationalists, for example, you know, Mexican, Asian populations could identify with us. You mentioned the Blacks are wise to the Jewish power a lot more than we give them credit for. You know, so they could, a lot of them could recognize the white genocide, you know, that we speak of as well. I mean, but a lot of us around renegade here, Mike.
It's not in their interest for Blacks to be concerned about whites being decreasing, right. You know, whites decreasing in the population of the United States.
Exactly. Yeah. But I mean a lot of the people here at Renegade.
I have friends that are African Americans. One stayed with me for about 10 days a week. He's a pretty well-known jazz musician, and he's a big fan of Minister Farrakhan and David Duke. I may have mentioned them in the past, but I'm not going to mention his name. But the fact is that he does have a very ethnocentric, very, you know, militant black outlook, and he doesn't. You know, he's blunt. He's honest about it. He would rather have a black president all the time. I mean, that's basically where he's coming from. He despises Donald Trump's agenda or any kind of white nationalist agenda. And he's very hip to the Jewish question. But again, you know, his sensibilities are going to be his racial genetics. He's black. I mean, he's black first in his heart. I'm not right. Pathologizing that. I understand
A lot of us around here, you know, at Renegade Broadcasting, have talked a lot about, you know, the premise of, you know, people, you know, seeing future potential to establish white ethno states in Europe and America. You know, could this be realistic? You know, different people with different attitudes. There could be other areas where people mix if that's their choice. It's not like you're trying to say the same for the entire planet or anything, but I don't know. What do you think on this topic? They're looking toward the future.
Before I get to that, I just want to mention this friend of mine, a jazz friend of mine. He actually doesn't believe in interracial marriages. He actually believes segregation is a good thing for Black America. He thinks segregation is better for Black America. He also thinks music should be divided by race. He doesn't think he actually thinks, for instance, jazz is should be black. He doesn't consider white people playing jazz as being true jazz. He thinks jazz is always to be pure about jazz. He thinks it always has to be sung by blacks and played by blacks. And it's an interesting, in some ways, he can be considered a black supremacist about certain things. But, you know, he's not the only one out there that I've met who's African-American who thinks segregation was better for black Americans. I don't know if I go that far, but there are blacks who think that way. And there are blacks who have no problem with interracial dating, but they have a problem with interracial marriage. They don't think that procreating should be outside the race. So it's not just white people who think that way. There are black people who think that way as well.
Mm-hmm. And Asians certainly can respect maintaining their their bloodlines.
It's just that Asians are such a small part of the population that it doesn't come to mind. But you know what? Now that you mention it, Asians are very, very, very racialist in their outlook.
It's just seemed, you know, interpreted as natural. You know, they don't have, you know, groups like the Asian cultures don't take to this social conditioning from the Jews. You know, that guilt that the Europeans, the occidental race.
That's a very good point. Steinleitz worded it that way, that Asian groups and Hispanic groups don't take to social conditioning for the Jewish agenda to be promoted. They just don't concern themselves about Israel, about the Holocaust. And yeah, you're right. White people do. And I don't know, you know, I know there's always this reference to white man's guilt. There's something about whites biologically where they always feel guilty. They're always feeling guilty. You know, people talk about Jewish guilt and Catholic guilt, Asians don't feel guilty. You always find Asians feeling guilty about things.
Mm-hmm. There's this one brilliant Indian scholar, Frank Raymond. He's actually been on Renegade here, but he speaks about the altruism that's so inherent to the European races, and perhaps preying upon our altruism is part of it.
I mean, it's a great quality aimed for in terms of your brother's keeper and helping one another. And I mean, these are great qualities. Except when you have outsiders who really don't care about white people and taking advantage of the situation, taking advantage of white guilt, and they become parasitic. You know? And whites then get taken advantage of, they get exploited, and they don't realize that they're hurting themselves.
And you mentioned, how perhaps if we wanted to take back, our nation.
Rose clouds of Holocaust.
Another break. Right back.
Rose clouds of flies. Rose clouds of bitter, bitter, bitter lies. When the angels of ignorance fall down from your eyes. Rose clouds of Holocaust, rose clouds of lies. Rose clouds of twilight truth, rose clouds of night. Rose clouds of harvested love all alight. When the ashes of life fall down from the skies. Rose clouds of Holocaust, rose clouds of lies.
I've always believed that Britain is a country of migrants. I'm Jewish. Some of my family came in the late 19th century. I'm Sephardi on my mother's side.
The Liberal Democrats will always stand up for a Britain that is open, tolerant and diverse. And in that spirit, I very much welcome the Jewish European Election Manifesto, calling for a strengthening of EU hate crime legislation. As a party, we wholeheartedly value the relationship we have with the Jewish community, both in Britain and internationally.
Life, oh, wrecking this show, oh.
And we're back. We're here with Michael Santomoro. And be sure to check out the book he is publisher of, Debating the Holocaust, A New Look at Both Sides by Thomas Dalton.
By the way, you can get her on, you can no longer get her on Amazon or Barnes & Noble. Again, these Jewish organizations succeeded in banning the book after being on the internet for 8 years. At one point, it was one of the best sellers on Amazon and in that category, history books.
And I just want to mention your website right now before we get close to the end. ReportersNotebook.com, ReportersNotebook.com.
And if they want to order the book, they can go to the website, DebatingTheHolocaust.com. But anyway, the bottom line is that my most important body of work was about 150 plus book reviews I wrote over a 17 year period. They eliminated it. And I wasn't aware of it until 2 weeks after it happened, but they eliminated it in January this year. And then about a month and a half after that, they eliminated the Debating the Holocaust in conjunction with about 30 or 40 other Holocaust revisionist books that Guillermo Rudolph is responsible for publishing. And it was on the same day that Barnes & Noble did it. So we know it was an orchestrated event. You know, normally competitors don't imitate each other on the same day.
And if anyone... If anyone has any questions for Michael and would like to call in, that call-in number is 747-999-6407, 747-999-6407. Michael, I'm sorry, before the break, where did you want to continue first?
No, I mean, I think people need to be vocal in a very rational, measured approach about Jewish power in our country. And if people can't have the courage to do it, then we're going to lose. We're already losing the battle. The fact that credit card companies are shutting down the potential, you know, the ability to process orders to sell books on the subject matter, Amazon eliminating not just me but others, hundreds of people who've written book reviews that are no longer on Amazon because the books are not there anymore. And you know, this is Jeff Bezos, who said on more than one occasion that he would never ever allow censorship to happen in the United States. But
I was mentioning
the power of the Jews rule our lives.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. There are always some exceptions, it seems. Up until recently, at least, it was against the law to call out for the assassination of the president. You know, I don't know. For some reason, suddenly now that one doesn't apply. I mean, there have always been a couple of things, like, you know, someone could be brought up on charges of slander in some cases. There have always been some exceptions.
I understand the law is still there. The law does exist about not, you know, making vocal or written claims about assassinating the president. But Kathy Griffin, by the way, has had visits by the Secret Service because of what she said about Trump, and her career has been damaged, by the way, because of what she said about Trump. But that's because the people around her, like Harvey Levin and Andy Cohn, they're big Trump supporters. I know it sounds counterintuitive, but they're both Jewish Americans, they're both gay, and they both support Trump. They're big fans of Donald Trump.
Michael, what do you say on the premise of, you know, forming an a white ethno state in Europe and or America. Basically if it were all one peoples, you wouldn't really have to. Some people have restricted freedom of speech to maintain a people's, but I can't see many of the people going against, you know, the best for the people in the press. You should be able to have freedom of speech in such a case.
Well, I think Kathy Griffin, I'm not a fan of her comedy, by the way. I don't think she's that funny, but she should have a right to express herself. And it happened to be anti-Trump, and she was on a no-fly list for 2 months. She continues to get harassed at airports. I mean, this is obviously coming from the top down. I said something I should clarify myself. I said there are Jewish Americans who are gay who support Donald Trump. It's because of one issue. Donald Trump was the only candidate that was willing to try to dismantle the nuclear Iran deal that we made. The Iran nuclear deal.
You mentioned you mentioned related to Jewish power, their control over the bureaucracy. You commented on the need for having licenses for so many types of businesses, criticized the IRS taxes, and this corporatism, which really is fascism of the government and businesses aligned against the people. I really don't even think it would qualify for the Third Reich's National Socialism to be called fascism, because it was not aligned against the people. You know, it was the corporations and government, aligned in the interest of the people at the very least. So in that sense, I don't even think that qualifies as fascism, but if that's your definition of it. But as far as the control of the bureaucracy in the U.S., that you think a lot of the Jewish power lies in, you mentioned these licenses, not just for whites, but for, blacks and everyone as well. I mean, is a problem, inherent to our social economic conditions, which maintains a lot of the Jewish power.
Well, I don't know if I used the word license or in what context.
You were talking about like for a different business or another that someone might try to have. They need a license, to do business, and that these things, should be outright abolished. Depending on whatever business.
I think we should have as close to a free enterprise system as possible. I do take a libertarian view on that. I don't think you should have a license to open up a roommate finding service, which used to be the case when I owned one. I think they did away with that. They used to have a license requirement to have a dating service, for instance. But again, because of the internet, I think a lot of these license requirements are null and void now. But like to be a cab driver, let's take Uber. Right now, for most jurisdictions they're in, maybe I'm wrong, but for most places, they don't need a license. Some places, they're making it very difficult for Uber to succeed. And, I personally don't understand why anybody ever needs a license to be a cab driver. I mean, some of these medallions, the medallions for the yellow cab industry in New York City is, I don't know if it's 300,000 or more, maybe a quarter, whatever it is, it's an exorbitant amount of money. I think it's like $300,000. It's outrageous. It's like a mortgage for the next 30 years of your life to own to be a cab driver. It's why do you make it difficult for people to want to work?
Yes. Well, yeah. I mean, that makes me once again think of, the economic conditions with the Third Reich I was mentioning once again. I mean, that they backed the labor, the collective labor of the population, as what the currency's wealth was backed by, and rejected the currently we consider corporations persons, but they rejected the loan industries and the speculative stock markets, just being able to make money from property, seeing that as a problem. And that is very inherent to the Jewish people. I mean, this even goes back to you know,
yeah, but they
you
don't
know,
have
biblical it. Times. But what is your
Yeah, but they're not going to be the only group that will do that, and they're not the only group that do that, that does that. And I mean, that sensibility is not a monopoly that only Jews have. There's a lot of Jews that are involved in parasitic positions. I mean, lawyers, for instance. Say about 25% of the lawyers in the United States are Jewish. It used to be a higher percentage, but whatever percentage, it, you know, whether it's 25 now or it was higher in the past, you can't get anything more parasitic than lawyers. And even the foreign lobbyists or foreign organizations and companies, they always go out of their way to hire Jewish lobbyists and Jewish lawyers because they're more well-connected in Washington, D.C. Well, when I say 25% of lawyers in the United States are Jewish, they're like 50% in Washington, D.C. They're almost half in New York City. In other words, they're more like a higher percentage in powers in centers where there's power, whether it be New York, Chicago, L.A., Washington, D.C.
The banking industry as well, for a parasitic industry. So
yes, I agree with that. And, you know, when they Jewish Americans contribute 50 to 60% of the Democratic fundraising drive for the president and 35% for the Republican Party, this is the reason why the Democrats and the Republicans bend to the way to the Jewish interest in this country and to Jewish sensibilities, because they have to tiptoe around the monies that they're able to contribute to the political parties in this country. 40% of the billionaires in the United States are Jewish or hyphenated Jews. They're contributing the majority of the Democratic money to PAC organizations, 60%, according to J.J. Goldberg in his book, Jewish Power. And at the time, it was 45%, and Richard Cohn has updated that data in the Washington Post to 60%. When J.J. Goldberg wrote his book, Jewish Power, in 1994, he said 20% of the fundraising for the Republican Party is coming from Jewish PAC organizations. Now Richard Cohn in the Washington Post says it's 35%. Whatever number it is, it's exorbitant. I mean, for a group that's 2 to 4% of the population in the United States, donating one-third to the Republican Party and almost two-thirds to the Democratic Party, they got us by the balls.
We have a little over 10 minutes left. But I'd like us to leave the audience with a bit of a positive message. You mentioned how a lot of things are being ramped up a bit without regard to the attempts on censorship and toward the internet. But I do think that there's something to be said for, you know, we should get away from the defensive position and more to an offensive position. And things like this Holocaust are a good mechanism, but I don't know, with the last 10 minutes or so, Michael, you know, I don't know, what would you like to direct the audience's focus toward?
Well, I think people should understand how systems work. And I'm not saying they're going to learn about it in the next day or two, maybe a two-year process, several-month process. But people have to make an attempt to understand how systems work. There's a reason why people contribute to a particular organization. It's not because they have nothing better to do with their monies. There's always some kind of agenda behind it, whether it be an ethnic agenda or an ethnic sensibility involved or a racial agenda. There's always something related to an agenda. And people have to realize that. They can't just go through life thinking whatever they see on the news or what they're being told by the newscaster is what they need to know. It's not, that's just scratching the surface. They need to go deeper. And I think the internet is the best venue right now, and may only be the only venue in our lifetime, for people to do their homework. And I think it's important to expose themselves to alternative media, such as the one I'm on right now. Now, I don't agree with everything that your radio station does, but it's okay. I don't have to agree with everything. It's important that I hear the second point of view or the third point of view or any contrarian point of view. I need to hear other people's perspectives. I'm not always right, and I hope I'm not right all the time because I'd rather be wrong half the time. I think people have to take an assertive effort to understand how systems function.
Okay, and as far as dealing with the the increasing climate, it does seem to be very anti-white. And you mentioned that not enough white people are willing to stand up for themselves, really, and pride
well,
for
people,
their.
You know what, white people or Gentiles, they have to have more courage. And that's the problem. And the courage doesn't come with guns. No, it comes with using your brain, speaking up, and explaining yourself. Explain that people in Texas who are eligible for aid from Hurricane Harvey should not have to be inhibited about their views about Israel or anything to do with Jewish power, or anything to do with any kind of other power. I mean, whatever political viewpoint people have who are victims of Hurricane Harvey should not have to bend and suspend their agenda or their, in this particular case, boycott of Israel to get aid. I can't believe we're living in a land, in a country that where nobody even talks about how outrageous it is. I mean, I can only do so much as a one-man shop here as a blogger to promote this news item, but I don't seem to get anybody shocked about it. I mean, people will express shock, and it lasts 5 minutes, and they go about their business. But nobody seems to want to, like, write letters to the governor of Texas or to local congressmen in Texas saying how outrageous this law is. The ACLU is advocating on behalf of the people who want to continue their boycott of Israel. Thank God for the ACLU in this case. And I think it's important that we support the ACLU, even though many times we may not agree with their agenda, but it's more important that they promote freedom of speech to the extreme as much as possible. And I think that's important for all Americans to embrace, is that we always have to, always have to have the contrarian, allow other people to have a contrarian view. Even if the alt-right was in a more powerful position than they are now, they should also always respect groups like Black Lives Matter. I don't think it's I think it's wrong for the left to try to suppress the right in their freedoms of speech. But should the right ever have the upper hand, they should never suppress the left point of view as well.
Yeah, at this point, I think just a lot of our listeners separate, from identifying with either the left or the right. Learning from some of the ideals, that each can share and have shared at times in the past. You mentioned you have a libertarian past, for example, but I really think that people need to get more toward an offensive approach, basically, and not be afraid to do that. So I don't know. It's interesting. You do have some good points that you share. I was curious to see what any listeners might have to say. If we do still get anyone who could call in, please feel free to. We do have a lot of replacement levels of immigration, though. In Europe as well as America, there seem to be multiple agendas behind a lot of it, but.
There's an organization that I don't know if it started like 10 or 15 years ago called the European Jewish Congress. I find it amazing. I find it amazing that there's all these organizations like this, European Jewish Congress. I find that amazing. You know, there's human rights organizations called the Jewish Human Rights Organization. I'm mind-boggled that anybody can actually concoct a name like that. I mean, usually you hear organizations like Human Rights Organization, period. You know, who ever heard of a... Have you ever heard of a Catholic human rights organization?
No.
I don't get it. It boggles my mind. I mean, I have to laugh about it at times because it's just too surreal. Like, if there's, I don't know. I think we're living in the dark ages. I remember a scene in one of these Star Trek movies. I don't know what century they were in, but they were making reference to 20th century medicine as being barbaric. You know, we make reference to the Middle Ages as being barbaric. Well, somebody somewhere 500 years from now, 1,000 years from now, are going to look at the 20th century and the 21st century and look at us as being barbaric in our behavior and our, what we're doing to each other and passing these laws, trying to put Norman Finkelstein in jail, putting Holocaust revisionists in jail, putting people who are boycotting Israel to not be eligible for relief money for Hurricane Harvey. I mean, I just, the idea that they're trying to pass a bill to put people in jail for 20 years if they boycott it. I mean, this is bizarre. We're living in the dark ages.
Certainly. And, well, yeah, we've had these Antifa incidents. And they're getting a lot of funding from quite a few sources. But I mean, we've heard of a lot of claims there's going to be more trouble in November. Like a lot of people are saying November 4th in the U.S. and I hear some other date overseas. But you know, this just seems engineered as for where things are going to be steered in the aftermath. You know, in a lot of these cases, you know. And it is interesting, though.
Yeah.
Well, no, I mean, I don't know. A lot of these events, it seems to be there's a lot of interesting connections. Just and I just analyzed the motivations. I'm sorry, what were you going to say?
No, I know we only have a couple of minutes. Just on a humorous note, I sometimes wonder, you know, with all this stuff about Harvey Weinstein, you know, the Hollywood producer. I sometimes wonder if he looked like Brad Pitt. I wonder if these women would be boasting about it, you know, like they had an encounter with Brad Pitt. They wouldn't be complaining, but because it was Harvey Weinstein, but I'm sure Harvey Weinstein was guilty of what he did, and it was atrocious behavior on his part. But sometimes I wonder if it's the dollar signs that a lot of these women are coming forward.
Well, it's strange how that story is getting so much attention when, you know, a lot of people point out that, you know, this has been going on in Hollywood for
decades.
You know, for decades and decades. You know, I think there was one story where we were citing someone was citing Charlie Chaplin, even.
Yeah,
you know, was known was for even, his encounters with young ladies. So I mean, yeah, it's been going on forever. It just seems like one of the distractions currently more than anything. And yeah, you know, they picked. Yeah, you know, quite a personality, basically.
But right.
I don't know. Yeah, we only have about maybe 2 or 3 minutes left, but everyone should check out the reportersnotebook.com. And yeah, Michael, we would look forward to definitely having you back on. Yeah, these laws are just getting more and more ridiculous. I hope we don't start getting more of them here in the U.S., you know.
Well, again, the Senate bill is still floating, and you never know what can happen. And hopefully Trump would have the courage to veto such a bill. And it won't, you know. And if he didn't, if he was to sign that into law, you would hope that the Supreme Court would rule it unconstitutional. I mean, the ACLU is going to court to rule what happened in Texas with this law that they passed in May to be unconstitutional. Well, anyway, it was great talking with you. It was a pleasure.
We certainly, we should do it again sometime. Look forward to it.
Okay. All right. So thank you very much for having me.
All right. Yes, thank you. And yeah, everyone, also do check out the book Michael published as well. When you have a chance, Debating the Holocaust, A New Look at Both Sides by Thomas Dalton.
Well, I didn't know. I thought the show was, does it end now or at 10 o'clock?
It looks like we have a couple minutes. Okay. Yeah, a couple minutes left here. My clock was like a minute or two fast or slow, rather.
You know, the only reason why I harp on Jewish power is because that's the power that's basically dominating our culture. I mean, if it was Irish power, I'd be talking about the Irish. If it was Japanese, I'd be talking about the Japanese. But whatever power it may be in whatever decade or century we're talking about, if that power is benign, we wouldn't care. I mean, really, does it matter whoever owns Rockefeller Center? I don't know, was it the Japanese or the Catholic Church? I forgot who it is that's supposed to own it. But if that power is benign, so what? Who owns it?
Right. It's, well, some people would still want
malignant. What?
Certainly. Well, some people would want, you know, to be ruled by their own people, but as well. But no, you make a very valid point. Yeah, most people wouldn't be as concerned nearly if it were benign in any regard.
Right. It's not about obsessing about Jews. It's not anything about anti-Semitism. It's about, I mean, who in their right mind would devote time and energy to try to pass the bill to put American citizens in jail for 20 years if they don't want to support Israel's atrocious behavior against the Palestinians? Mm-hmm. Who in their right mind would deny people their rights as American citizens to FEMA money because they support the BDS movement?
In a disaster zone where, you know, yeah, they're just barely hanging on after the disaster on top of it. So it is quite astonishing. Thank you very much, Michael. Look forward to having you back.
Okay.
Watch one choosing hands. Watch wounds filling gas. Another spin to the barrel. Another clone to marry in. Susie Gray, one in men. Then the cold lines of sin. Destruction burning all it can. Deduction. Another lost cause.
You're not a computer, but that doesn't mean you need to stop listening to Renegade Broadcasting. A good way to catch our shows while you're on the go is by finding us on TuneIn Radio. There is an app for your iPhone or Android, TuneIn.com. There are also plenty of other ways to access the 24/7 stream right on the homepage at RenegadeBroadcasting.com. And that first button underneath the player is a direct link to our page on TuneIn Radio. Please remember to follow us and share with your friends.
Membrane unhook. Unlock a misled. Mistook the image as dream. While these tears of joy cascade. Innocence, it seems, has done the same. Life without honor on him in an instant. Doubtful cordials of pain have led us to distant lives, mingled with similar caverns of shame.